and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, December 15th, 2023. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. Well, can you believe it, listeners? Another year has come and gone, and there was no shortage of things to discuss on Rabble Radio this year. It's become a bit of a tradition here at Rabble Radio to share a best-of collection for the last episode of the year, so if you'll indulge us today, we've selected a few of our favorite Rabble Radio episodes of the year to share with you. Will your favorite make it on the list? Be sure to let us know over social media which episode spoke to you the most this year, and who you're hoping to hear on Rabble Radio in the year to come. Now, without further ado, let's dive into the top Rabble Radio interviews of 2023. Start in March, when Rabble Labour reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga was joined by Ethel Tungahun to discuss the expectations and assumption of care work in Canada. There is an invisibilization of care work in Canada, particularly for women and racialized communities. The two talk about how a complete breakdown of colonized thinking, learning, and working in Canada must take place in order for true labour equity to be achieved.
I kind of want to touch then on the aspect of underpaying or even not paying care work at all. You know, have you done any research into the unpaid care work that falls onto, you know, the shoulders of women?
Absolutely. Well, so for this project itself, like, I mean, the Metatag project, I'll talk about that and I'll talk about other projects. What's really interesting is that a lot of the women who were working in these homes and households weren't being paid for all of the hours that they worked. And they kept working anyway because of power structures that made it such that it was harder to say no. For some women, especially those whose immigration statuses are tied with their employers, that also meant that they live with their employers. So the power dynamics are really quite vast there, the power inequities, I mean. And so it's harder, even if your contract specifies that you're only supposed to work 8 hours a day, it's harder to kind of fight for your labor rights, knowing that, you know, if you try to be too aggressive about it, your employers could say, well, you know what? I don't need your services anymore. Thank you so much. Goodbye. And what then happens is not only do you lose your job, you also lose your immigration status here, right? So when we think about, you know, all of these reasons for why it's harder for some care workers to ask to be paid for all of the work that they've provided, we have to look at these larger power structures as well. I think, you know, beyond kind of the Metatag project, what's really interesting is that, you know, when it comes to the care work that women have been asked to do, I think it's hard because there's this expectation that women are innate nurturers. So even in my job as a professor, there is the expectation that my job isn't just like researching and teaching. It's also providing emotional labor and emotional support. And so there's an emerging body of work showing that for a lot of female professors, and not even just professors, but women in other professions, there's the expectation that they should provide that type of emotional labor to keep institutions running. And they're not, and we're not compensated for that too, right? And I think it makes it a little bit harder to kind of think about women's rights in that way, because I think when you think about emotional labor, that's not something that frequently factors into how workplaces think about kind of workplace responsibilities, right? So if you're trying to be paid for all of the work you've put in, it's not like on a timesheet you can put as part of your tasks, emotional support, right? So a lot of this goes unpaid, and more kind of crucially, a lot of this goes unrecognized too.
So how can we, you know, fight to have this emotional labor, you know, recognized and even compensated?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it depends on the sector that you're part of. And I also think it depends on how institutions themselves see value and see worth. And one of the great things that I'm seeing post-pandemic is a lot of folks, a lot of workers are just not content to keep things running the way they're usually ran. So one of the most inspiring things to witness during the pandemic is the emergence of more social movement activists asking for better labor conditions. And I think beyond asking for better labor conditions, a lot of these activists are also asking to overturn inequitable power structures. So it's not just about kind of compensation, although of course that's something we should factor in, but it's also about thinking of other ways of running these companies, these universities, these care homes, right? And that could be thinking about how people there are also ensnared in these power relationships as well, right? And thinking about how, for example, the university can also be a site of colonialism and white supremacy, right? So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, one of the things I'm noticing is people aren't just looking at policy solutions such as pay equity, which I think is important. They're also looking at the structural foundations of these flawed institutions to see, well, maybe we want to move towards abolishing these power structures. So yeah, no, I think that's what's really cool, witnessing the emergence of these movements for change.
Then, in April, Stephen Wenzel sat down with Dr. Brandon Doucette about his new book, About Canada Dental Care, and the challenges of Canada's dental care system. In this year's federal budget, the Liberal government announced a $13 billion plan to expand dental care to families earning less than $90,000 a year, fulfilling the government's commitment to the New Democrats. This, of course, is a major step forward for dental care in Canada, but is it enough? Or do we also need to rethink the structure of dental care in Canada as a whole?
Now, we've talked about this kind of under the scope of being a health issue, but in a lot of ways, and you wrote about it quite a bit in your book about how oral health can also create social barriers in life. And so could you kind of talk a little bit about how oral health is also a social issue?
Absolutely. So, you mean you touch on the fact that like our smile has such an impact on our self-esteem, how we interact with the world. Obviously, having missing front teeth or visible dental decay can affect our employability. This is a big problem for many issues, but basically it's one of the reasons people get trapped in the cycle of poverty. You could imagine if you can't afford to access dental care and you have missing front teeth or visible decay, not being able to find employment leads to kind of further exacerbating that problem, falling down the cycle of poverty and not being able to get out of it. So I see ensuring access to dental care is a way of helping people live dignified quality of life and trying to help break the cycle of poverty as well. I think we could all imagine how difficult it is just being able to chew, you know, if something as simple as that. How do you go out, eat with friends? It's so hard to interact socially, as well as how much dental pain can impact just being able to sleep. How can you focus at work? How can you interact with people in, you know, a high quality way when you've been suffering from a dental pain, which if anyone's actually experienced this, you know how miserable that is. And it's hard for people to wrap their mind around, I think, too, because I think there's been some shift in this, but people tend to blame people more for, you know, their oral health problems than they do, you know, if someone has like a heart attack or something. There tends to be more acknowledgement of like their societal structures that lead to certain problems for those health problems. But it's the same thing for dental care as well. If you're stuck in the cycle of poverty, you're much more likely to eat unhealthy foods, not necessarily have the knowledge of, you know, what causes cavities, how to prevent them, all of these other things that lead to people who can't access dental care to have more dental disease as well, which are all problems that kind of feed into each other and make the problem even worse. An analogy that I like to give in a case like this, there's actually two of them that I think help people relate to this issue. One of them is, imagine if every cavity you've ever had in your life led to the tooth being extracted, because that's what it's like for someone who's poor and can't afford to get access to dental care, because the longer you wait, the worse it gets until it just becomes, you know, unbearable and you need the tooth taken out. It's no longer savable. So that's exactly what it's like for people who are unable to access dental care. Another story that I like to give that I think highlights kind of the social element of this is the last year I've worked mainly, you know, I worked in private practice before this, but the last year I've worked mainly as a dentist in a federal prison. And seeing people who are, you know, full grown adults come to me and say, this is the first time I've been to a dentist in my life. Some, you know, there's other people say this is the first time I've been to a dentist in my adult life. But that's a very regular thing for me to hear because people just haven't been able to afford to go to a dentist sooner. And I've had people come up to me and tell me, like, I'm supposed to be released from prison soon, but I'm actually going to defer my release so I can get all my teeth taken out and get dentures made because I know if I don't get this done now, I'll never get it done in my life. And they know, like, I'm not going to be able to find a job. They know how difficult their life is going to be. So they actually choose to stay in prison longer, which it's so hard to wrap your mind around what their living conditions actually are to actually come to that conclusion. And I think having a level of empathy for these people and realizing that, you know, very subtle differences in our own lives could lead us to being in their shoes and actually having the humility to say, like, you know, we do need to treat people with dignity and respect.
In June, Olivia Chow made history by becoming the third woman and first ever racialized mayor in Toronto's history. Ahead of her being elected, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel sat down with Chow to talk about her plans on making Toronto a more caring city.
When my mom and dad immigrated to Canada, my dad had mental health issues, couldn't work. And my mom, even though she was a teacher, she couldn't find teaching positions. So she ended up working as a maid in a hotel and then worked in the laundry department. My dad was a teacher, school superintendent. There wasn't enough teaching job at the time. So he tried driving taxi, and this is before GPS time. So it was getting lost. He couldn't hear the dispatcher well enough. And it was just hard, right? And so he just had a nervous breakdown. And ended up being quite violent against my mom. So my poor mom, it was hard. So working hard and coming home and just a lot of difficulties. But with her one income, she was able to still pay the rent and some money left, and we didn't have to go to a food bank or anything, right? The time now is totally different. Far too many people pay more than 50% of their income on rent, or they have to take on a second job and they're exhausted, or different shifts, and it's just tired, or they're constantly worrying about, hey, how am I going to afford this, right? Is there going to be any money left? Is my landlord going to evict me? It's just like, oh, the housing affordability is in such bad situation. You know why? Because City Hall have stopped building affordable housing. We're in a crisis situation. 200 people plus each night are being turned away from shelters, right? So we have to have more shelters, but ultimately you have to have more affordable housing, or it just won't work.
All right. And my final question for you, Olivia, you know, as many people know, you are married to the leader of the federal New Democratic Party, Jack Layton. And I'm wondering, what have you learned from Jack that you'll carry on with you as you make history of your own?
What a sweet question. Yeah, he's passed away for a while now, but he has several lines that we all know, right? Be loving, hopeful, and optimistic. Hey, if I'm not hopeful, why am I doing this? if I don't believe that things can change, that we can make progress, you have to be hopeful and optimistic in doing that. My slogan has been, you know, let's create a caring city. That's really about love. It's about caring for each other. We absolutely need to do that because, you know, in the depth of despair, that mother, Andrea McAleese, whose son was killed in the kill subway, said to us, let's care for each other better and let's look at the social conditions and make sure people are not in a crisis situation. So it's about caring. It's about love, right? That's very much Jack. The other piece that he said was, hey, young people have lots of energy. Encourage them to get involved. I'm surrounded by a lot of young people in my campaign. Great. So that's another lesson. So yeah, you know, open the doors. Come check me out at oliviachow.ca. And the third thing he has a saying that he always says, that don't let them tell you it can't be done. Aha. All right. Journey is long. Not going to be easy. But, you know, don't let them tell you it can't be done. Let's go and do it. And let's do it now.
And in June, Stephen Wenzel sat down with Red Buffalo Nova Weipart, an Ojibwe Two-Spirit transgender artist, filmmaker, and storyteller, to talk about how their multi-layered Indigenous identity informs their creative and professional work.
So in 2020, I got the Indigenous Storyteller-in-Residence position at the Vancouver Public Library, and that happened right at the peak of COVID. And I was afraid, you know, that I was going to lose, you know, my contract and my residency. But when everything shut down, you know, I kind of pivoted all the programming to be online so I could make it, you know, virtual presentations. That kind of launched my career into being a storyteller. And I've just had so many different, like, lovely individuals, you know, reach out to me to come and tell my story, because I didn't realize, you know, that I was a storyteller. My friend gave me the job posting and they were looking, you know, for an experienced storyteller. And as I was reading it, I thought they were looking kind of for an elder, you know, and someone who, like, has these, you know, creation stories or these other stories about their culture and, like, whatever nation they come from. And I kind of took a moment, you know, there, and I was like, wait, as a filmmaker, that's how I tell my story. You know, so I asked them if I could do kind of a hybrid event between, like, half filmmaking, half storytelling, because that's kind of what I wanted to do. And yeah, they loved, you know, what I was telling. And I depict, you know, my story of coming out as trans and two-spirit and all the, like, kind of the holistic nature of my being, you know, like, kind of the spiritual, physical, emotional, like, intellectual journey that I've had. And I'm very transparent, you know, when I speak my journey about, you know, my mental health struggles, you know, having to hide away because it became a safety issue for myself. I grew up in a very small town outside of Winnipeg. You know, when I realized that there was no representation around, there were no gay people, no trans people, no Black people, no people of color. Like, I felt that there wasn't really a safety net for me to, you know, come out. And so that really took a detrimental toll on me as, you know, I performed as a cisgendered woman for about 25 years of my life. And there came a time right before I came out where, unfortunately, yeah, I didn't want to be here anymore. And in that moment, I was really kind of, like, gripped with this idea, you know, that there were tangible steps that I could take in this world, you know, to become happier. Like, I could take HRT, like, hormone replacement therapy. I want a top surgery. Like, I've always known, you know, since the moment of self-awareness that I've, you know, wanted to kind of present more masculine. So I was 25 years old when I finally came out, and I had just graduated my undergrad at Emily Carr, and I graduated with a BFA in film, video, and integrated media. And, you know, in that moment, I started again. You know, kind of like my life came about again. And that's really kind of the crux of my storytelling gigs, you know, that I get booked for, is that I tell my lived and felt experiences as performing as kind of Little Rainbow Girl all the way up until I got my new name, you know, Red Buffalo, in another naming ceremony.
Affordable housing and the housing crisis has been a hot topic on Rabble Radio this year. In August, Georgia Kelly sat down with Marva Burnett, National President of Acorn Canada. The two discussed the ways Acorn Canada is committed to achieving livable and affordable housing for all Canadians.
So I want to talk a little bit more, actually, about legislative campaigns, because you talk about having demands for your landlord and your building, you know, for them to get rid of the pests. But you're also looking at sort of bigger solutions like rent controls and stronger protections for tenants. So maybe you can tell me a little bit more about those.
We at Acorn, which is all of our tenants, because we are Acorn the tenants, we decided that we wanted to get more out of just, rather than every other week we have in an action, because we have roach infestation and the landlord isn't doing it, and we have mole infestation. So we decided to start a License Your Landlord campaign, which we started in sometime 2005, around there. We started to get our landlord's license, because we figure if you have to get a license to drive a car, go fishing, you had to get a permit to go camping, why are you just having somebody owning a building with, you know, 700 people living in it, and there's nothing for him to do except for just buy the building. So, and on top of that, there's so many issues that's going on in these buildings. We can go out every day and we could have actions upon actions upon actions. We will get that one issue that we're working on fixed. But how many apartments do we have in Ontario? We have over 5,000 apartment buildings. So how long is it going to take us to get through 5,000 apartment buildings? All of them might not have the issues that, you know, most of them have. So we decided the best way to go about it, it's this. If we want to affect change wholeheartedly in every rental unit in Ontario, the best way to go about it is to legislate changes. Because once that is enacted, there is going to be rules and laws that they have to follow. Because we know that the system they have with the fines, that's like, a landlord would prefer to pay the fine than to fix whatever they need to fix. So what we've been doing is we've been lobbying our city councillors, lobbying our member of parliament, provincial parliament, and even our member of, you know, federal parliament, because they're the one that states, which it should be so, housing is a human right. And if we're going to have housing, shouldn't housing be healthy? Shouldn't housing be affordable? You know, it should be all of those things. We've been doing this for years now, lobbying to get change to the legislation. We at ACORN, we are a group of tenants who we don't see ourselves stopping anytime soon until we get what we want. We ask and we ask and we ask, because what we asking for, they not want their needs. And if you're not going to meet us, we'll come to you. That's how we operate. And we don't give up. And until we get these changes in legislation, we'll continue to do it. Somebody might say, why you continue? Eventually, we'll get it. That is our mindset. And we know it.
And finally, in November this year, Labour reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga sat down with Jade Ho, a Labour Studies instructor at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. The two discuss what is possible for university students when they are given opportunities to learn about and get involved with social justice and labour issues in their own communities.
Speaking of your class, can you tell me a bit more about kind of how you used that space to, you know, encourage community engagement and really get your students immersed in these issues?
Sure. Yeah. So like for my class, one of the principles that I bring to my what I think is really important is because, you know, sometimes when you're learning in the classroom, you do feel like you're like kind of separated from whatever you're learning or whatever issue that we're talking about, right? Like, I think that we can give as much, you know, critical theories and this kind of tools to students. But at the end of the day, sometimes what you're learning in class, you still feel like, okay, maybe this has nothing to do with me, right? So I think one thing that for me that's always really important to bring into my class is that not only this has anything to do with you, you can actually do something about it. So, the class that I shared in this panel was this class I had this past summer in the Global Asia program here at SFU. The course is called Global Asia in Vancouver, you know, a really broad topic. So it just means that I had a lot of freedom to do what I wanted to do. So the goal then, like when I was designing this class, I thought it was really great because it's so local based, right? It's so place based. And this is where the student literally live and go to school. So I felt that we will explore and learn from, you know, the different efforts, experiences, and histories of community organizing, different types of social and environmental justice, solidarity building that centers people of Asian descent in Vancouver. And in my class, 90% of my students are Asian descent as well. So I think that it's something that also to open their imagination of like what we as people can do, right, within our community. So the whole course was organized into basically four different units. The first unit, it's kind of like an introductory unit, lay out some theoretical foundation to talk about the interconnection between anti-Asian racism, settler colonialism, capitalism, and indigenous disposition, right? To do this, just to give them a little bit of like, you know, theoretical tool. And then we started going into participation. So we specifically focused on housing, labor issues, border crossing, immigration issues, food security and health. So for this, we heard from organizers. So for example, we invited South Asian and Philippines organizers to come in to talk about organizing migrant workers and to talk about what is migrant workers, right? Like what happens with migrant workers and this program of temporary foreign worker visa. And a lot of students, I think, even though they grew up here, this is something that they've never heard, right? And then through talking about this with the organizer themselves, and a lot of the students are also from the same community, I think it really made a much more intimate kind of connection for them, right? And then to expose the kind of this myth of Canada, of being good to immigrants, right? This whole idea. And I think that it was also a lot for the student to kind of grapple with, okay, you know what? Because many of my students are second generation here, right? Like they feel certain gratefulness to live in Canada because they don't have to go through the hardship that their parents had to go through in their home countries. But then again, they also feel guilty for, you know, like being on Indigenous land, learning about all of these things. So I think being able to learn all of this in community gave them an avenue to turn this feeling of guilt or this feeling of don't know what to do, this feeling of where do I find my belonging into action, right? Into a community where change is happening.
What an amazing year of guest speakers and interviews on the show. If you'd like to revisit and listen to the full version of any of these episodes, be sure to visit rabble.ca/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And once you're done there, visit us on social media and let us know what interview stood out to you the most this year, or what guest you hope to hear on Rabble Radio in the year to come. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week and this year. Thank you as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Also, Rabble is in the middle of our winter fundraising campaign. If you'd like to share some care this holiday season, please consider becoming a monthly donor or gifting a one-time donation to Rabble today by visiting rabble.ca/donate. Thank you to every single journalist, writer, activist, artist, and organizer who contributed to this year's content on rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music, and finally, the biggest thank you to you for tuning into Rabble Radio every single week this year. Rabble Radio will return on Friday, January 12th, 2024. I'm Brand Doyle, and I'll talk to you next year.